Last week was the fifth annual Friends of Red Hill lecture series, and this year they had Pat Murphy. You may have heard of Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. That was out in 2006. There's a DVD going around the community. You may have seen it. He was the co-producer and co-writer of that documentary. He has a new book out called Plan C, Community Survival Strategies for Peak Oil and Climate Change. In it, he describes the benefit of small and local community solutions. If people are wondering what to do when oil gets rather thin and hard to find, he gives us some solutions for local community as the answer. Very good book. I highly recommend it. Today's show is Pat Murphy, Plan C.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
I better get right back here at the beginning. I'd like to introduce one person, Faith Morgan over here on my right, who's my wife, who's also been on the trustee of the Community Solutions Organization, and who was the person that really did the Power of Community thing. I'm going to talk about several things. I'll talk about our Community Solutions Plan C, but I'm going to emphasize very strongly something called measuring sustainability. And I'm going to be talking about houses, cars, and food. This is my fourth talk in the last few days, and what I've learned is that Canadians have a lot to teach me, particularly about the houses, so I'm very busy collecting information to take that back to the United States. Our organization was formed in 1940 by Arthur Morgan, who was the founder of Antioch College and was the first president of the TVA, who did a lot of river reclamation and built dams. He was taken, this is under Roosevelt, and Eleanor Roosevelt had taken him to the White House, and he set up some incredible performance standards to do some great things in the Tennessee Valley area. Morgan went on to be an educator, and his focus was on how do humans develop, and he thinks they develop best in a particular place over generations. And that we need to interact in a face-to-face manner, that maybe Facebook and the internet is not the highest level of what we get. It really doesn't quite equal conversation when you're looking the other person in the eye. And it has the qualities of what our hometown is. And, you know, for me, that used to actually bring up a feeling about what's your hometown. And you talk about, this is my place, this is where I came from. That's been changed. That's changed a lot. Small communities have been decimated. And I think that the villain of that is cheap energy, because we were able to start creating a lifestyle where we didn't even need each other, and we lost touch with each other and with our homes. Now, in 2003, we began studying climate change and peak oil, because we see these that are factors. They're going to lead to a small community resurgence, which for us is absolutely great news. And it represents that trend of what we hear a lot of popularly talked about, localization and relocalization. So that's who we are. And when I started this, and I'm a mathematician, a physicist, and a sort of a quasi-computer scientist from 30 years in that industry, and I started looking at things, and I really need to quickly come down to getting a certain set of numbers. And I think that we need to start looking at some numbers, and that's going to help us plot our way through. But we do have four threats to humanity, peak oil, of course, being one of them. It was actually CO2 now being the really big threat, because the other threat of peak oil was threatening poverty and depressions and so forth, and the CO2 is threatening life on the earth. The third thing I'm going to talk about is the record inequity that exists, which I think can be said to be partly the result of cheap fuels and with cheap credits. We have far more violence, suffering, alienation today than I think we've ever had before. as of course relates to our current economic crisis. And finally, we can talk just a little bit about population. Can the Earth support 7 billion people? I don't come here with any solutions for that problem. We know that our CO2 levels are 387 parts per million and going up. That James Hansen from NOAA told us a long time ago that the 350 parts per million is the maximum that we can take. This chart is actually was prepared under the Bush administration, but he never released it. And when Obama came in, that report came out. And this is really what's interesting is this really represents Obama's position rather than mine or somebody else. And so we're really seeing a commitment from the administration to it. Now, there's great forces that are fighting against this, and we don't really know how things are going to shape up in Copenhagen, but Copenhagen is a step, not necessarily the solution. I don't know if you all participated in the 350 day. I'm sure many of you did, and I think that was a really seminal event where we can bring people around the world and saying we need to get this number down. Well, this is the familiar Association for the Study of Peak Oil chart. ASPO says that peak oil occurred in 2008. The International Energy Agency, the World Energy Outlook report, last year acknowledged that peak oil was real. This was a huge, huge concession on their part, and it's led to a lot of criticism and attacks on them. And there was this interesting story about Fadi Barral, who was the chief economist, and he was being interviewed in Washington, and some woman said, "I represent this peak oil campaign, and you said for years and years that there was no problem, and now you're saying this is a real situation." And he says, "Yes." He says, "That's what we're saying." And she said, "Well, what changed your mind?" And he says, "Well, we went out and measured the wells, and that's where we got our data." And she says, "Well, what were you doing before?" And he was saying, "Well, we were sort of using reports from the oil companies and so forth." And she says, "How can you say that?" And he said, "It's true." And I think that that was really important for Fadi to acknowledge that it wasn't some excuse. It was a realization that we had been using whatever cheap data we could come up with, and now we'd looked at it, and it was a serious problem. I understand this new report that I believe is coming out next week talks some more about it. And, of course, all these things have to be heavily sanitized, and you have to kind of go through it and find where they're really making their predictions. Now, this is something that I always include in my problems of the threats that are facing us, and that world inequity now is the highest in history. Ivan Illich wrote a book on this called Energy Inequity in 1974 in the first energy crisis, and he pointed out that as we use more and more energy, the inequity in the world had increased. The green here, the shorter bars, really represents the wealth measured by some parameter based in U.S. dollars. And it really showed in 1820, maybe the United States and Canada were twice as wealthy as, say, Nigeria or some other African country. We didn't have this huge disparage. Well, since that time, we now have seen that the disparage is enormous by looking at the yellow, the gold bars, where now America, the United States, is always something like 10 or 20 times the wealth of many of the nations that are most of the rest of the world. Now, I think this is critical because when we go to Copenhagen and when we enter these discussions, the third world is going to take a really hard line. And there's a phrase called contraction and convergence, a movement that came out in the late 90s or early 2000s from Europe. And it's the realization that not only do we have to reduce CO2 generations, but we have to converge on some common measure, at least some approximation of it. Because I'm going to show you that the average citizen of the United States is generating 20 tons and India is generating 2. And are we going to ask India to cut 30%? Well, we cut 30%. They're not going to do that, and they're actually making that clear. China and India are taking that position. So I think that one of the hidden blessings that may come with the crisis we're facing who can now start dealing with inequity, which is the core of the social injustice that we see that's paramount in the world. And finally, we do have an unsustainable population, which overrides almost everything. One can really get caught up in this, and I don't spend too much time on it because I know I've got to go reduce my CO2 generation. But I think this conversation will begin, and it's going to begin by first acknowledging this is a problem that secondly has to enter the debate, and eventually we're going to have to start setting some goals and then some action plans. That might take us a generation to do, but eventually we'll have to face up to that as well. So I think the common factor of all these major four points is cheap energy. And peak oil tells us it's going to end. Climate change tells us if we consume even the rest of it before it ends, it's going to be very dangerous. The inequity in oil really reflects the inequity in living style. And then the population really shows that we, with our wonderful approaches to agriculture, converting food to oil, that we did whatever any animal does, is when there's lots and lots of food you reproduce, and when some is taken away, it changes. No one really knows how to get out of this, but there's more and more people becoming aware of the crises, and they're proposing solutions, and for my work, I just see it happening all the time and every day. And then when I come up on this little trip and discover things that are extremely innovative, they're far ahead of the things I thought I was doing that was innovative, it really gladdens my heart. So now I want to talk about my approach and what Plan C is and compare it to the other plans. Currently, Plan A, which is the world's plan at the moment, what I call the black plan because coal and oil are black, and that basically says we're going to generate more and more of these. We'll take the Canadian tar sands and hope to God it doesn't completely destroy Alberta. But we will keep our current lifestyle at any cost, and that's probably currently 90% plus of the population. Plan B, which is the green technology and solar, wind, switchgrass, dozens of options, this is focusing a lot on primarily on intermediate electricity generations. And the proponents of this, at least in the United States, are Al Gore, really the leader of that, Lester Brown, who's been a leader in a lot of the environmental NGOs. And this, again, offers that we can maintain the current lifestyle. And when I say the current lifestyle, it's the lifestyle of consumerism and consumption and materialism. And it's what, unfortunately, we've evolved into. That's a smaller percent of the population. And I offer and suggest that we're going to have a high satisfaction, low energy lifestyle, in which we will curtail our fossil fuel usage, and we will change our current lifestyle, but we're going to do this for the better. Now, this is less than 1% of the population. Is this less than 1% of your area's population? Maybe I'm in the right group. I need to address a big issue, which I would almost say is the modern religion of Western man, is that technology is going to save us. We had about 10,000 years of agrarian living, which we could also use the word sustainable. Then we discovered coal and the steam engine, and then after the Second World War, we've entered into this hyper-technology living. Yet there's lots of people that are always quoting numbers, and I think that someone who's 85 or whatever it is says 90% of all the oil has been built, been burned since my during the period that I've been alive. And looking at the numbers, we just went on this tremendous binge of using energy right after the Second World War. And that's a very, very short time in human experience. It's really about a lifetime. So our modern worlds, we've become an energy world, and we focus on the use of technology, and it turns out that technology is really quite limited, particularly in energy. Maybe not in computers. Maybe this computer here is the equivalent of 10,000 of something like a supercomputer that I used to work in, which would cost $7 million. But the car hasn't changed very much. The car that when I was starting the computer business it still costs roughly the same normalized for some change. We tried a fuel cell, and we spent 30 years on that effort. We spent 90 years on electric cars, 40 years on fusion. We've done quite well with ethanol, except now we're not really sure it saves any energy. And for 10 years, or 10 to 15 years, we focused on green building, and that also hasn't saved very much energy. So I think this question of technology will save is an important one. I think our energy sources are limited. We certainly know about oil and natural gas, although there's now a big perspective that we're going to go out and frack tight gas and with horizontal drilling, and that will save us. But when you actually get into those numbers, again, it's another kind of overstated opportunity. You know all about tar sands and what that can do. We don't have enough resources for fission, and we've never been able to work out fusion. Our renewables, biomass, and I was called on this about burning food for fuel last night, and he said, what about switchgrass? And I said, well, we don't have any switchgrass fuel. We just have some promise of it, but right now we're still using corn, which is a food. Hydrogen is we've almost now lost all interest in that. And the photovoltaic and wind power are proven, but are they going to scale? And scale's a big issue. Can we take something that provides 0.5% of our energy and have 20 years to get that, and suddenly by a government program or some buybacks, take that up and multiply it by 10 or 20 or 30 times? And I think that's really questionable. And I also don't want to risk the climate on making sure that would happen. And I've asked the questions, why are there so few options? Are we at a point of diminishing return on energy technology? Not on computer technology, but on energy technology. And I haven't seen a lot that's been added since the crisis of the 1970s. And I was heavily involved in that crisis because I was a builder at that time. And I changed my building practices in about 1 month. The devices, which I've already mentioned, are limited, and I've talked about the fuel cell and the electric vehicle. The current poster child is the pluggable hybrid electric vehicle, and at least in the United States, this is now considered to be a slam dunk. President Obama announced that it gets 150 miles per gallon, and then the president of General Motors announced, no, it's only getting 230 miles per gallon. Now, they don't run yet, so you have these people arguing it. But when you go into the literature and look at what they're talking about CO2 emissions, it's about 15% better than a hybrid. And so I think it's another technical fix which has a small likelihood of making a significant difference. And again, I ask the question, why are there so few options? Is our technology... is it a blessing or is it a curse? And we need to have a serious dialogue on that. Certainly I got up here by a car. Fortunately it was a hybrid and I'm using technology. But we have to look at it and see, is it the benefit that we thought it was? So I talked about plan A and B, and I want to talk about plan C. And the first thing is I note that this is really our community survival strategies. We're a long ways from now from talking about should we be more or less sustainable, because we're really worried about survival. And the numbers that come out and the predictions that come out from the IPCC, it just gets worse every report. And we can't wait. We have to do something fast. And we have to cut deep, and we have to do it relatively quickly. All the governments are agreeing, all the major governments saying, yes, we have to cut CO2 emissions by 80 to 90% by 2050, and that's 3 to 4% a year. Now, some of the governments, like the United States, picks a year that was really high, so we don't have to cut quite so much, but it really doesn't make too much difference. It's still an enormous challenge that's facing us that we have to deal with. So how do we get there? Well, I thought a lot about, well, what could I do? What could I suggest that the airlines do, for example, or the car companies, what they should make? And sometimes we spend a lot of time doing that. But I said, well, I have to start cutting the energy under my personal control. and I live in a house, and I eat food, and I drive cars, and I need to, and I look at that, and that turns out to be two-thirds of the energy consumption in the United States. So that comes back on me, and what can I do in consumer choices and other intermediate technologies to get those numbers? And that's what Faith and I are doing. We're going to be the first at 90% in our neighborhood. Now, there's another thing that I want to mention is that Plan C includes what I call a community context. We really have a value system because technology sort of creates us to be a certain way. And then the economic system that supports it, currently our hyper-capitalistic system, requires that we act a certain way. And first, what we know is we're competing, and we always want to get a competitive edge, and we send our children to college just so they can go out and compete in the world. And secondly, we want to hoard things. We want to have our stuff, a bigger Hummer and a larger house, so that we can have a lot of things, and we don't have much interest in sharing. And finally, we're consumers more than anything else, and we don't think of the future generations. But a community person is more of a saver, and they're making changes because in their mind it's not only their children, but it's their grandchildren, and they know where they fit in the scheme of things. So a sufficiency lifestyle is, to a certain extent, a moral and ethical lifestyle. But the other thing is, it's a context where curtailment is not suffering, and that happiness is in relating, not in accumulating. And then coming back to, I believe it's the Quaker phrase, that live simply that others may simply live. There was a speech by a senior minister from Bangladesh, and he says, if Americans continue their lifestyle, millions of people in low areas of Bangladesh will die. And I think that's something that we have to really look at, is we are, in a certain sense, killing the planet at large, but we can also find millions of people are going to be affected by the rise in sea levels. And community is a cooperation principle. We currently have a high consumption, competitive approach to life, and we really need a rather high consumption. We need a high satisfaction, cooperative approach to living. Now, our film, that's just a cover of the film, and some of you may have not seen it, but we picked scenes from what we saw of Cuba, of showing the way they related as people, one to each other. And there's an example which certainly lifted my spirits of a community that they didn't voluntarily curtail. They were curtailed from outside forces. They accepted it, and they used the strength they had in community to survive it, and also then to pick a lifestyle that would increase that. Now I'm going to talk about some solutions, and there's a lot of science behind Plan C. When we look at who have been predicted these things, these are not charlatans. M. King Hubbard was a very well-respected petroleum geologist, and the modern predictors like Colin Campbell and Jean Lahoray, who formed ASPO, their knowledge and the data and what they're using in peak oil is accurate. Certainly the climate science, with thousands and thousands of climate scientists arriving at a consensus, is more or less proven. In terms of our psychology and sociology, I don't know if you've ever read Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. Is that a familiar book? He talks about what we have created. The idea of bowling alone, I used to be a bowler, and bowling was you got together with the league, which was either your work or your office or your friends and neighbors and so on, your cousins, and you went down and bowled and talked. And it wasn't really about bowling. It was really about socializing. And now what Putnam points out is we bowl alone. We don't have families and friends doing that. And then ecological economics is another field of study that's really making strong strides to show us the directions we need to go. So our research is really focusing on intermediate technologies in buildings, personal transportation, and food. And part of it requires us to expose a lot of the false technical promises, which are really significant. But it also requires us to start measuring sustainability, and I'm going to talk for about six charts and try to leave you with the idea that if you can't say, if you can't measure how much CO2 you're generating, how much you have reduced your generation or what period of time, then I think you will not really know whether you're doing the right thing and it's moving in the right direction. And this requires a form of thinking, which is the per capita thinking. And by the way, I put a slogan here, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And we need to understand energy and CO2 accounting. We need to understand what energy return on energy investment is, life cycle analysis, embodied energy. All these terms which most of the people in peak oil and climate change kind of pick up. This is not something you need to go over the University of Waterloo and take a semester course. You need to sit down with three or four of your friends, read some books, and write up a piece of paper and says, okay, I got this concept. Now, from my perspective, the three key macro considerations are the CO2 generation, energy consumption, and income as measured by the PPP values, which I'll explain a little bit later. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about how the world's organized. What you see here in blue is the United States. And then in yellow and gold, you'll see Canada and the rest of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Now, I've taken out of that Turkey and Mexico, which we kind of moved in and made part of that because they were our southern border states and a source of cheap labor. But they really fall into the underprivileged part of the world, so that's why they're in that category. Now, this is a chart that it's my main motivating chart. And it's the CO2 emissions per capita, and it's 80% of the world. I picked the 33 most populous nations and said, okay, this is what I'm going to focus on because the problem is clear if you don't have to worry about 200 nations. It's just a convenience. Also on this chart, although the United States is a country itself, it represents its own special category. Right beneath Japan, you see the OECD, which is that composite of nations. I stick that in there to show you how that fits. And then below Thailand and above energy, you see the brown, which is the rest of the world. And right away, you can start to see the huge gaps that we have to overcome. And you can also see, when I talk about inequity and the moral issue, that China and India and other people looking at this are coming to Copenhagen saying it's no longer appropriate for an American to generate this amount of CO2 and ask us to change our life. We are currently on the world average today at about 4 tons per CO2. That's the red line to the right. And where we have to get by 2050 is 1 ton of CO2 yearly per capita. So this is the measurement that I start with. Is this is the challenge, and this is what I know I have to do. I want to make just a brief comparison. This is another way of showing it, the same countries, and it's energy consumption. And then if I go to the next chart, I show you that these are pretty much similar, trying to remind us all that CO2 comes from generating fossil fuel energy. Now we see down there France, it kind of sticks out a little bit because it uses a lot of nuclear power. But, of course, nuclear power has its own deadly toxins as a result. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the income for these same nations and lay that out and show you a similar pattern. PPP stands for Purchasing Power Parity. It's a way to normalize incomes from all across the nations. This data comes from the International Energy Agency, and there's a similar data set from the CIA. And they're similar. The numbers are slightly different. Now, the question is this related to energy, or is this just a coincidence? Well, we always say our economy runs on oil. And when I think, well, how's my economy doing? I say, well, what's the size of my paycheck? That tells me a little bit of it. And I believe when we start to see that what we call success and material prosperity is really a measure of how much CO2 we are generating, then we're going to be kind of looking at the big elephant in the room. And that's when, at least I've done that, and I've kind of said, okay, I understand this, and I know what I need to do. This is just another comparison to show you the differences. There's, of course, exceptions like Russia, having gone through this tremendous trauma of the dismemberment of the nation. is still at a much smaller rate, even though they have a lot of oil to burn. They have to rebuild the country. Now, what I did is I moved these the blue and the yellow and the brown over to another curve, and I'm actually using barrels of oil instead of CO2 because I want to tell you how I've derived my goals. And I want to make the point that I have a sense that I have to become more in equity, so I have to go for very, very, very deep cuts. And this shows you in a slightly different form the U.S., the OECD, Canada, Europe, Japan, and the rest of the world. Now, I can put this and lay on it and compare the U.S. food, cars, and homes and say, we really have to get this down, and this is the target that I'm taking. So what I've tried to say is make the case that we have to do these deep energy cuts, that we have to measure them, we have to lay out a plan which has metrics associated with it. I was at a great restaurant where they said, you know, this is really great food and nothing comes from more than 100 miles away. And I thought, well, that's really nice. And I said, how much CO2 did you save? He says, what? And I said, well, if you were going further, now you're doing this, what did it save? And he says, I don't have any idea. You know, this is something we just did. And so I don't know what he saved. Maybe he saved a lot, or maybe he didn't save very much at all. But we can't all startlingly shift to a 100-mile diet and not know whether it's going to make the big difference, because maybe they've been better off to change the light bulbs or to put some sort of something over their windows. Now, my model for this, which I'll talk about, is a German passive house, which at least some of you here, I understand there's an ex-councilman, Dave, somebody or the other, already has been building these. And I certainly learned that there's people in Canada that are already doing this. I'm going to talk about smart jitney, which apparently also, because I've met other Canadians, it says, yeah, I've been talking about that as well. And talk about some of the changes that we can make. And finally, I'm going to talk about food and the relationship to fuel-based industrial animal products. So I hope you understand that I'm coming from the numbers, and it takes a little while to work out, but if I do that and I set my targets right, then I think I'm going to make it. So some final numbers on housing. This shows the history of the U.S. The top line shows the persons per household, and the red line shows the growth in the square foot per house, and the bottom dotted line shows the increase in square footage. Now, I was alive and well in 1950. I remember that was a great year because it was the Catholic Jubilee year. We were a Catholic family, and we were told that this is the year that we could do all kinds of good things and we wouldn't have to go to purgatory. And I remember what they were, but being an altar boy, they told us you couldn't sip the wine any longer. But that was I was being raised in the Ozarks in a small town about the same size of the town I'm currently living in. And I was fairly happy. We had four people, my brothers. We had bunk beds. There were four of us in a room. My cousins had the same. Our general approach in life was in the summer is how can we get out of the house before we get chores? Because if we could get out of the house before we got the chores, we were gone for the day. Our parents never worried about us, and it was a good life. Now we have huge homes and very, very lonely people. U.S. residents are even about twice what it is in Europe or Japan. Now, this is a pure cultural issue. We don't need 800 square foot, and we're going to have to start looking at this and moving the houses down in size. Then that's the first step. Now, I want to talk a little bit about energy use, and I'm not going to try to explain this, but our energy use is so well studied. It's incredibly well studied in the United States and also in Canada. There's just reams of data on it. And this shows at the top of it is what I'm focusing on is residential buildings where everything goes. And this means you have to figure out what you're going to focus on. For example, heating and cooling are close to 50%. So that's a big item to focus on. In the United States, 50% of the energy is used in buildings, either to operate them or to build them and to take them down. And we have a huge number of residents, about 130 million, and they're going to have to be retrofitted. Now, I already mentioned, again, I'm a numbers guy, that green building is too little, too late. The LEED and Energy Star programs in the United States have been ineffective because they're only touching about 5% of new construction, and they're saving 15 to 20%. But Kyoto says we have to save 80 to 90% by 2050. So why would you build a building today that uses 15% less energy than something the other contractor didn't pay any attention to? You know you have to go to a much deeper cut. Some of this is very simple, and we've known it for forever, which is the thicker the envelope, the thicker the walls and the floors, the thicker the glass, if I have one pane or two pane or three pane, is the better off the building is. On the right, we've been building these kind of skinny buildings. We put in a huge furnace. We distribute it quite frequently by taking it out of the house into the cold attic, where we dump maybe 30% of the heat and bring it back into the room. Well, why can't we build very, very thick buildings with very, very small heating systems? And what we do is we just put the investment into the building instead of into the energy that we're going to be burning for 70 years. This is really not isn't complex at all, but we've never really taken a look at it, which is kind of shocking. So now I want to get to the good news, which is this is all being done. This is an example of the first United States German passive house. It was built in Bemidji, Minnesota about 3 years ago. I'm not going to go too much, you know, looking at the diagram. It says super insulation everywhere, triple pane, some heat exchangers, things that when you make the building really tight so you get fresh air, have to bring in outside air, and on its way in with the other air going out, you transfer the heat. It's a device that's been around for 30 years. So the Germans have started doing this because their commitment to climate change is much stronger than certainly our nation's. About 4 or 5 months ago, I was at the 13th Annual Passive House Conference in Frankfurt. There were 1,200 attendees from around the world. There was a huge contingent from China, for example. Not very many Americans. There were 100 presenters. We toured homes and schools and buildings. There's been 20,000 of these built to date. It's been 18 years since the first one was built, so it's not a new technology. And I've already mentioned it's really great windows, heat exchangers, good insulation, and sealants. They are achieving the 90% heating and cooling reduction that I said is needed. I want to say, again, coming back to the numbers, people that are doing this right now are, at least in terms of the heating and cooling, because I'm not going to yet talk about the TVs and the rest of it, their buildings are going to make it, because you can do this 90% reduction, and the extra cost is 10 to 15%. So when you have a technology which is a kind of tested, then all you have to do is implement it, and that's a big start for us as nations, is to simply say, I need to change my building codes, and yes, it's going to cost a little bit more money, but if you can't afford that, you should build a little bit smaller house, and then it won't cost any more money at all. Now, we do have the challenge to retrofit existing buildings. This is something that Faith and I did on a carriage house where we basically took the walls and moved in and made them thicker, went from 3 or 4 inches to a foot or more. We took the roof, which was open 2x4s, and we put in 2x12s, and we had a 9-foot first floor, and so we put a foot of insulation, made it an 8-foot. And then we put in a heat exchanger and replaced the windows. So this is a model for retrofitting. It costs way too much, I'm not even going to tell you, but you have to do these things. People have to do it and say, oh my God, that sure cost a lot more. We have another fellow in the town of Urbana, about 20 miles north, who took another small house and did it. We have a fellow that's taken his industrial building and doing the same kind of thing. And we're in a town of 3,500 people. Plus, we have two new passive houses that are being built. So, I need to really say how great it was when I started meeting people like at the university and at these sessions. It was just astounding. We were sitting in, what is it? Well, and there was a woman from Toronto speaking, and she was talking about the Now home, and she described the passive house, but she described that she had built five of them. And I said, how can, this is incredible, you're doing passive houses. She says, well, I didn't quite meet the numbers. And I said, oh, well, then you're building 95% of passive houses. But this is already a program that's underway. And there was a major conference that she was a speaker that was held in Toronto a week ago, and 400 builders attended. So these things are well underway. We just haven't yet got the public to know about it and the governments to get more involved, particularly in changing the building codes. Now, number two, let's talk about the private cars. The United States has 220 million. We generate 45% of the auto CO2 in the world. We buy 13 cars in our lifetime. We're always making payments. Some time ago when we decided to have big homes and cars, the wives went out to work, leaving the children to fend for themselves. This was, again, a cultural choice. We didn't need to do this, but we did. We have horrible fleet mileage, 21 miles versus 42 in Europe and 47 in Japan, and we can't replace all these cars. The Prius, all hybrids are selling maybe 2 to 3% of the cars that are sold every year. And they're less than 1% of the cars on the road after 10 years. This is another example of it's not the technology, it's something else. If we wanted to double this, we could simply order everyone to start building Priuses and to stop building everything else, which would not be acceptable in this culture. I want to mention a little bit about Jevons Paradox, which people are starting now to talk about. Jevons pointed out that the more coal was available and the cheaper it got, the more that was burned. That we never take efficiency and reduce our consumption. When we get things that are more efficient, then we buy more and use more energy. So it's not going to be efficiency. And if you look at this, the first chart on the left shows the fleet growth, and the second shows the increase in fuel, assuming the fleet growth is with these very, very more efficient cars. So the question is, what would it be like to go from 750 million 30-mile-per-gallon cars to 3 billion 100-mile-per-gallon cars? The answer is the problem gets worse. Toyota just announced that they were building a new plant in India because they were trying to catch up with the Nano or whatever it is, this car that costs $1,700. And I can see them getting in there and competing and maybe get the prices down to $1,500, and 600 million Indians will buy them. And we can't do that. We have to stop the idea of efficiency. Then we talk about another cultural issue, is at least in the U.S., drivers tend to drive alone. We average 1.5 persons per trip, and we'll have 5 to 6 seats in that vehicle. This, again, is a cultural thing. When I was a young boy being raised in this little town of Monette, Missouri, and I'd say, well, I need to go somewhere. And my mother says, well, I can't take you. You know, in fact, she'd say, your dad has the car, because we didn't have two cars. And I would complain, and she'd say, just hitchhike. If you want to go, then go out and hitchhike. Can you imagine giving instruction like that to your children today? But that's what we did, and we never had these issues of safety. Our houses were unlocked, and it was a different culture. And it's a culture, by the way, that's still common in that ROW, that 82% of the world. Now, I don't think that mass transit's the answer, even though it's advocated. And I've been doing a lot of studies on this, going back and looking at exactly how many have been built, how many people are riding them. We can talk about some miracle in Washington, but it doesn't do anything for Los Angeles. And I took this number out of the United States Transportation Energy Data Book, and you see where the private car is, that's BTU per passenger mile, and the SUV, then you look at bus transit and rail transit, not much difference until you go to the van pool. And now you say, well, that's a big difference. That looks like a big drop, maybe a 60 to 70% drop. I've been criticized a lot for this recently, and I've actually got a big project to go in and pull the numbers out. And as I look at it, I'm really discovering that I'm on pretty solid ground. So how about a jitney? Well, what's a jitney? Well, it's defined as a small bus that carries passengers on a flexible schedule, or you can call it an unlicensed taxi cab. But the essence of a jitney is shared transit. It's not private transit, and it's not public transit. It's shared transit. And every existing car can be a jitney. We could create this system tomorrow in this town. And it's very common in about 85% of the world. A friend of mine was in Ukraine a couple years ago, and he was driving with someone, and he saw this huge field covered with these buses, like what's below there. And people were kind of racing across and running, and they were going in and out. And someone said, well, what's that? And he says, well, that's the jitney exchange. And that's where people come together and make their transfers. And you said, well, it looks like a muddy field. And he says, well, it is, but, you know, that's the way it's working here, and it's working very, very effectively. And Ukraine really went through tremendous trauma when the Soviet Union collapsed. But these are models that are there, and what I'm starting to see is, in the third world, people are gaining more and more features that we have, and they're doing it without creating these expensive energy-consuming systems that we did. So the smart jitney will provide anywhere, anytime, any place pickup and drop-off. It's not limited to any tracks, to any lines, or to any schedules. It's possible by new communications and GPS technology and cell phones. And it's a software problem. It's not a hardware. All the components already exist. If you've got some good programmers around here, you could start building one. Now, the first U.S. real-time rideshare conference was held in MIT in April. And there's a funny story about this. There was a venture capitalist that was sitting in his office in Boston, and he said, we have this big problem. Why can't we share rides? So he called MIT, where he came from, and talked to his buddies and says, hey, why can't we share rides? We have a lot of empty seats. And they says, I don't know, but we're MIT. We'll have a conference. And he said, okay, if you fund it. And he says, okay, I'll fund it. So MIT said, they put some graduate students and said, go out and find and see if anybody's doing this. Well, we got a call from them because they had read some of our work, and we went to the conference, and there were seven companies there who were building this system, and one of them was from New Zealand. And it was astounding to see what people were doing, that people had run through these kind of simple numbers, figured it out, and they were out doing it. And of course, the big news is one of them is operational. That's Avego of Ireland. Once more, the Irish do it first. And they're actually negotiating in Massachusetts and California. And the good news is you can get the software today. If you want to start your smart jitney system, you have to buy an iPod and software, and it's available and it's free because Avego, all they're going to do is take a penny on every ride, and the rest of it is kind of free. Well, if you have a million people riding every day, then Avego is going to do okay. Now, target three is food, and this is going to be the hardest change, and I think this is where we get into behavior modification. And my perspective is we can fix a lot of the CO2 problems from food by not eating any more factory meat and giving up a large number of our processed foods. And everyone's been writing about this, Michael Pollan and Marion Nestle. And the UN released a report in 2006 that says more CO2 is generated, more CO2 equivalent, because that includes methane, which is a lot worse, from livestock production in the modern way that we do it than from cars. And then also associated with that is something that we never ever talk about, is the incredible suffering that goes on in contained food operations. That's something that you just don't want to talk about. So we know what we have to do. We have to garden. We have to buy locally grown foods. John Michael Greer is a friend of mine and a writer, reminds us the organic gardening is contemporary. It's a new concept. It's not something that we really kind of go back to. And we saw a lot of this in Cuba, where they have this whole science, and that, you know, people are studying this insect and what they can do. And so when we go back to that, we're going to be using soil in a way that will be sustainable. It's not like we're going to go from one place to the other. In this case, again, we know what to do, and we can make this 90% change by behavior change and by starting to use our build up our own victory gardens. So now I just want to mention a little bit about what we're doing in Yellow Springs in terms of our local community of about 4,000 people. We had ordered a $3 million substation, and myself and about seven other people went to the council and the citizens, and we just kept showing some of those charts, like, are we going to grow our per capita usage? And the council thought, you know, we're not. We can't. In fact, if we said that, we wouldn't be elected next time. When you lay out the numbers with them and say, are you going to vote for that chart, they think about it. So that was canceled. Then we were working with our supplier, because we have our own distribution system, and we were buying into a coal plant, and the council voted, and we're out of that coal plant. So we don't have any substations. We don't have any new plants that are coming. And we formed an energy task force for long-range planning. And I'm on that task force. We also have a joint group between a joint effort between a company, Net Zero Homes, Community Solutions, and the University of Dayton. And this is a partnership. And the University of Dayton has figured out that you can go to the building department and get the house plans and get the square footage. You put that into the computer. You take the electric bills to put those in, and then you do the same thing with the natural gas bills. You put these in a big mix. Then you have a student on a bicycle that rides by every house and takes a quick look at it and writes down a few comments. For example, does it have a roof, south-facing roof that could support something? And you put that in there, you grind that, and then you can say, these are the locations in the areas that are using an excessive amount of energy. And instead of trying to get everyone, let's say, to change the light bulb, which is not, it's a good effort, is you can actually go in and start finding out what people are actually doing and then showing the information. Now, this was, they didn't have the technology, but there was something done with the Canadian Mortgage Company and a professor from one of the Canadian universities. And when they got all the information from a sample and they took it to the people, what they discovered, the high users were just furious and withdrew from the study. And the low users were the ones that cut the most, because they were committed, but now they had some more information to go on, and they said, oh, I can do even better. So we're really proud of that effort, and we hope that that'll come to fruition and we can make a big cut in our utility bills. And so that's basically what we're doing in our town, except we've done two passive house retrofits, a passive house retrofit on a commercial building. We're starting two new homes this week. So time's getting short. Peak oil may have occurred, and we know how serious climate change is. Survivability, whatever you want to call it, means an 89% reduction of our energy use. Stephen Tanner, who was the architect and builder of the biohouse, says in all his talks, incrementalism is death. You can't start piddling away at this and lose a few more years before it finally gets serious. I don't think we should wait for breakthrough technologies like carbon capture and storage and pluggable hybrids. We have to change our habits and way of life. In a certain sense, we have to become different people and have a different culture. We have enough intermediate proven technologies and oncoming things like passive houses and smart jitneys that we don't need to wait for any more research and development. I think there's going to be a tremendous community resurgence. I think that our period right now is very similar to the Roaring Twenties before the Great Depressions. I often go back and just review that period to find the similarities. And of course, we have all these smart people that are building these financial Ponzi schemes, and we're doing the same thing back before the Great Depression. And of course, we've all been spending like there's no tomorrow. Our free market, at least in the United States, has simply become a license to steal. I think it's very hard now for any U.S. citizen to trust anything that comes out of our banks and our financial institutions, and also from the car companies, which we now own, by the way. So community provides the alternative value system, the values of caring and sharing, and I think that you all know what I'm talking about here because you're living that. I'm just going to skip this, some more of the details of what we're doing, but I want to remind you what Einstein said is we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking that we used when we created them. We need some very, very different thinking, and I'm trying to give you an example of some new form of thinking and some new values. My values are those around community, about helping us all and working with each other to get through this. And we're proposing extremely high satisfaction and a very low energy way of living. And my last little chart down there is something that's so close to my heart, is the way that people did it in Cuba. So thank you very much, and I'll be able to, glad to take any questions.
Who is going to be giving the official thank you for Pat's incredible talk. Sarah's the co-chair of the Community Food Security Stakeholders Committee, and she's going to thank Pat formally.
Hi, everybody. So just a quick note on this, the committee. You just heard its very long name. It's actually a subcommittee of the Board of Health of the city, and we're working to explore some of the issues around food, particularly that the ones that Pat has brought up here today. So if anyone wants more information about that, I'd be happy to give it to them later. I just want to thank Pat so much for his talk. I think it was really inspiring. It was very interesting. There was a lot of facts in there. And I think hopefully we've all learned something that we can take home with us. I think he's given us a really good sense of the kinds of problems that we face. I'm sure many of you are already familiar with them, but it's a nice overview of how much we really need to do in order to survive. But also has given us, I think, a lot of reason for hope, how helpful other people can be in the world, and how much we can gain from listening and collaborating and really working together. And so there's so many opportunities for us in Hamilton to be doing a lot more, and I would encourage everyone. I know I was really inspired by a lot of the, not only by the talk, but by a lot of the community organizations that had things set up today. And so if this is, I know many of you have been doing this for a long time, but if you haven't been, think about working with some of those organizations and think about what in Hamilton we can be doing to move this work forward.
And that was Pat Murphy talking about his Plan C, How to Survive Peak Oil. If you want to find out more information about Community Solutions and Pat Murphy, you can contact them through the web at http://communitysolutions.org.
There are many places you could probably buy this book. Brian Prince is one of the best independents, and he supports the community. He brings in a lot of speakers. And Joanna Chapman, you may have forgotten about her, but she's still around, and she is still involved in selling these books and CDs and DVDs. And you know, if you buy the book through Joanna, the proceeds go to help other groups. Just maybe a little dollar or 50 cents, but it goes into some of these other grassroots groups and helps support them so that they can bring speakers like this to communities like Hamilton, where I can bring them to you and you can hear them, even if you couldn't get to that lecture. So here's the email, Chapman Books, all one word, CHAPMANBOOKS at hwcn.org. You'll get the book at a lower price. There's no storefront to go to. You'll arrange a mutual meeting place like the Sky Dragon where you can go and pick up the book. That's it for this week. I just heard on the CBC that Copenhagen may not be the meeting that everybody seems to think it might be. Once again, it's a starting point. It's not a finishing point. Our prime minister doesn't get it. He's saying that India and China, they have to stop their emissions first before Canada will even think about curtailing their own. He had the nerve to say that these other countries give more emissions than even the tar sands. This is a guy with his head stuck past the tar sands. It's down there in the bedrock. It's amazing to me how uninformed he is. folks, it's not going to be our government that helps the future and your kids get along. It's going to be us. It's going to be tiny little communities of a handful of people, 50 to 100 people, who learn how to live together and make their own food and stay fossil-free.
This has been The Other Side of the News on 93.3 FM. Thanks for listening.
Redefining Radio.
Sync FM.